So the first piece of advice is don't have a kid when you have a startup. You've already not listened
They're
there,
right
but
behind you.
yeah,
They
it's
can
too
hear
late.
you.
It's too late for you.
Ego is this really effective like propulsion system for starting companies, from scratch and having the audacity to say, I don't like the way the world works. I think it can be done a better way. Here's my vision for that.
All right, folks, welcome back. This is Hong Kwan from FundBMC, and we're recording a special episode here, episode 8. Let's call it the coronavirus edition, with my friend Brian Wang. Brian is a longtime founder. I knew him from what, way back when, 10 years probably. Was a VC for a while over at 500. Was a PM at a couple big companies. Big startups, not big companies, but a couple well-known startups, and now has started a executive coaching business. So welcome to the show, Brian.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me on, man.
But the thing that kind of stuck out to me is, like you said, founders have to be ready, right? And they have to be willing. And I think a lot of founders hit those inflection points. And it could be around a fundraise, it could be around a new market or a new product, or it could be around anything. But, or usually from my point of view as a recruiter, it's usually at like 20 employees, 50 employees, 100 employees, like their management just doesn't step up. It needs to step up to be able to manage a much bigger team. So again, with founder mindset, in my mind at least, it's like founders have huge egos, right? Like we kind of have to. And we have to like have this supreme confidence that we always are doing the right thing and we're always taking care of our people and we're always taking care of our customers and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Is there ever like, do most of these people coming to you, like they just realize what bullshit that is? Or is it someone else telling them like, hey, maybe you should go talk to Brian or go look for an executive coach because you're not really at the level yet?
Yeah, I think it varies. I think there are multiple paths for any one person to ultimately decide to work with somebody like me. But I think your point around ego is really important because I do agree that ego is this really effective like propulsion system for starting companies, from scratch and having the audacity to say, I don't like the way the world works. I think it can be done a better way. Mm-hmm. Here's my vision for that. Yeah. And so there's definitely a lot of ego involved, at least for most human beings. And it's that exact force that propelled them that ultimately ends up getting in the way for them. Mm. I'm thinking already about a couple of clients that I've been working with for some time. And actually I just had a session with one right before this. And for him, I'm not sharing any identifying details, but for him, so much of his identity has been defined by this image, this self-image that he has, which is, I am a visionary, I'm strategic, I can see from 10,000 feet above, and my job is to paint that picture for my team, but then not really get involved with the nitty-gritty details. They'll figure that out. And that what we started to realize over time was that created a sense of disconnection and aloofness, mm-hmm. right? People didn't feel like they could actually understand him very well, nor did they feel that he cared about them mm-hmm. as human beings. And the more he started to understand that, we did the work and we started to understand like, oh, okay, he actually had some experiences growing up that really reinforced this idea that he derived value from being right, from being clever, from having all the right answers. And that actually came at the cost of letting other people have the answers. Mm-hmm. Because if he wasn't the person with the answers, then what was he?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Right? Why are you here? Mm-hmm. Right? That was kind of the thinking. And the more we were able to shine a light on that, the more he was able to make a conscious shift and say, oh, you know, maybe I can start to let go of that a little bit. And so to put that into practice, what he did was he decided to set up time with several of his direct reports and focus on one key skill. And that key skill was just for him to listen. And specifically in listening, it was to practice the pause. Because for him, it was so easy for him to, like, once there was a moment of silence, he'll fill that silence. He's like, I've got the answers. Let me show how clever I am, which was feeding his ego. It was continuing to reinforce that self-image that he had. And he realized that this was his pattern. So he made this conscious effort to notice when there was a pause and there was silence, notice when he had that urge to say something, and just to shut up. And he would wait 3 seconds, and wouldn't you know it, the other person would just continue to speak and let more and more out, because there was more space that he was providing in those conversations. And what ended up happening was some of these folks, some of whom he'd been working with for years, shared incredibly personal, incredibly intimate details about their lives. He wasn't asking for that, but that's what ended up happening in these conversations. And in the end, there was a sense of connection between him and his teammates that he's never actually experienced before. And you know, he was telling me that he suddenly felt this feeling of freedom and liberation and power, because he didn't have to be so, you know, strongly gripped by that old image of himself. He was actually able to let go a little bit, and in the process, feel more connection with his teammates, feel like he understood them better, and feel like they understood him better. Feel like there was a sense of care and possibility. And it also had these other weird knock-on effects where he had more engagement, he had more joy, a little bit more lightheartedness in the work, because he was less concerned about how he came across. And so, you know, it's, we'll see kind of how that continues to evolve in terms of the business and morale. But I have a strong suspicion that the more he deepens that skill of listening and, you know, letting go of some of those images that he was, you know, gripping onto so tightly, the happier his team is going to end up, the more productive his team is going to be, the more creative his team is going to be, and the more satisfied he's ultimately going to be in the work.
As a new dad yourself, is there any advice that you would like, given my experience? I've got, my kids are walking around the back making lunch. I've got a decade of experience, or more than a decade of experience.
Yeah. What advice would I be seeking about being a dad?
A startup dad, particularly.
Startup dad, yeah. I suppose the first thing that comes to mind is, how do I make sure I remain as engaged and as present with my kids as I want to be, given that I have this instinct to work a lot?
Yeah.
So, yeah, what do you have to think about that?
So the first piece of advice is, don't have a kid when you have a startup. You've already not listened there.
They're right behind you.
Yeah, it's too late. You. It's too late for you. I think this actually brings up a good blog post that you wrote about, kind of, are we working hard enough? Mm. So working hard enough is like, are we getting the results that we want? Or are we putting enough hours? You know, like I was of the team no sleep for a long time, and I would basically work, you know, essentially like a 9 to 5, more likely 8 to 6, right? And then I'd have dinner with my kids from 6 to about 9 when they went to bed. And then from 9 to 2 a.m., I'd work again, right? So that's my second shift. That's when I got a lot of work done with some of our partners around the world, particularly in Asia with manufacturing. And then, like, I'd go to bed at 2, and I'd wake up at 6. And it's like 4 hours a day for like 10 years. And that's not good. I would not recommend that. Recommend it. So I'd say, what I would say now is, like, you have to make sure that you're putting enough time and effort into both things. And, like, you can say you want to be a great dad, you can say you want to be a great startup founder, but where you put your attention, where you put your focus, will tell me where your priorities are, right? Like, it's that simple. So I still make time for dinner with my family. I don't take meetings at that time. I push everything off. Like, usually after 5 o'clock, if you need to call me or something, like it can probably wait till the next day, right? Like there's nothing that important. And for me, my priority has always been family first. And that's something I've kept, you know, through 10, 20 years, initially with my wife. And then now with my kids, it's much more important now with my kids. I think I kind of lied a little bit to my wife when I said like that was priority, because the early days of those startups were pretty much all in. So I think now looking back, like, you know, I think my kids are, they may or may not agree with me, but I try to be a good dad and I try to spend the time that I spend with them. And I try to make them a priority more than the business. Because at the end of the day, the business is really to create the life that we want for them, right? It's, you know, I can work from home most of the time. I can see my kids as much as I want now more than ever. But like having that flexibility was actually more important to me than like being a founder, being a CEO, right? Like I don't care about the titles necessarily. I care about spending my time the way I want to spend my time.
Yeah, you know, what was coming up for me just now was the key phrase was family first. Mm-hmm. And that really kind of speaks to your kind of order of priority. And the visual that was popping up in my mind was, you know, the analogy that people have where you have a jar and you fill it with a bunch of stuff, like big rocks and little rocks. Yep. And to me, the big rocks are family, and you have to place those in first. And there's still remaining gaps in a container that is the jar. And then you fill that with the smaller rocks that are work and other things. But you've already placed the big ones in there. They're not going anywhere.
Yep.
And in practice, I think that, you know, that translates into, you know, strong boundaries. You know, like I've got a schedule, I've got hours that are going to be dedicated to family. Work has to fit in around that, but not mm-hmm. the other way around. And I will admit that I think to date it's been work first, family second, but that's very, very quickly changing for me.
Yeah. I will say it's much, much harder when they're young, because like they're on their schedule and you're on their schedule and you sleep when they sleep. All right. Like you don't really have much control over that. My kids are now 10 and 13, so like they're pretty independent. I figure in a few years they probably won't even want to spend time with me. So we're sort of enjoying this quarantine period, if you can enjoy such a thing. But the reality is like we only have, you know, 5 more summers with them before they're off to college. Maybe a little bit more with the younger one, but our time is limited, right? And even more so, like a lot of my identity is tied into my company, of course. It's almost like a one-to-one. Like if you're buying a Karmic, you're buying a piece of me, or you're getting my expertise and my advice and all that stuff. But at the end of my life, I don't think that's going to be the thing that I'm most proud of. So
yeah, that resonates.
A little bit morbid, but I think like we all.
No, not at all. That resonates. That.
Having a family is like so much more rewarding. A lot more work and a lot more difficult to manage in terms of like your ego and your personality and your past and your triggers. Like I can go into my own past, but having a rough childhood and trying to provide a good childhood for the next generation, I think that's the biggest challenge.
Yeah, I think that I absolutely agree that having and raising a child is definitely more difficult than a startup, which makes you really, really appreciate the fact that billions of us do it. And also just not to mention all of the incredible amount of hard work and sacrifice that, you know, frankly, most women are doing and not enough men are doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to be conscious of being an equal contributor, equal partner, in my role as a parent. And the point you had around, you know, parenthood really surfacing all this stuff for you, your past, your own experiences, your triggers. Yeah, I feel that. I feel that hard, you know, especially when it's like 3:30 a.m. and you're operating off of no sleep and the baby's screaming and you and your partner are getting into a fight, and you're just like, what is going on right now, right? Your brain feels like this is my life now and it's never going to change. And along with that, all the stuff starts to pop up, all your past traumas, all of the stories that are constantly in your head are coming in screaming, and that can create a lot of negative feelings, a lot of negative emotions. And it's distressing at the time, you know, but that stuff passes too. And if I zoom out, I try to remind myself that fatherhood, just like a startup, just like anything in life, is a vehicle for me to examine my own self and understand how can I be showing up in a better way, and what are the things that I need to resolve to be the person that I want to be, or to fulfill any particular role in the way that I want. And that ultimately just comes from a place of responsibility, right? Like, I think it's really, really easy to fall into the trap of woe is me, you know, I'm a victim of my own circumstances, or, you know, let me blame this other person or outside force for why I'm having this shitty experience. And I do that all the time, right? I'm human just like anyone else. And I have to constantly remind myself that I'm ultimately responsible for my own conditions and outcomes. And there, I have a lot more control than I think I do. And there's a lot of power in that reminder, I think. So it's just something that I'm constantly having to remind myself of.
But yeah, the early years are really hard.
Yeah.
I guess the only thing I would say is like, get as much help as you can. I know it's hard now with, you know, the shelter in place, but with our first child, we were like, we're going to do this. We read all the books. We got all the stuff. We thought we were ready. We were not ready. And we turned down a lot of help, which looking back is probably silly, kind of like ego thing to say, hey, we got this. We know what we're doing. Nobody knows what they're doing. Like, it's hard. I want to get right into it. And first question, what is exec coaching?
Yeah, it's a great question. I get that a lot. I think, you know, the definition, even for me, and the way I explain it has changed over time. And, you know, the best way I can explain it now is it's a way to develop a leader and to unlock their own personal power and potential by better understanding all of the inner stuff that they're bringing to the work, the assumptions that they're making, the mental models they're bringing, the emotional triggers that they're carrying around, all the narratives that are always in their heads when it comes to their roles as leaders, making decisions, managing teams, handling high pressure situations. All of this stuff is really like the inner game when it comes to being effective in those roles. And so my role as an exec coach is to help them understand and lay bare all of the kind of mechanics, if you will, both kind of from an intelligence and cognitive perspective, but even emotional and gut perspective into all that. And once they understand those blind spots, those inner workings, they have conscious choice. They can decide how they want to show up in their work and ultimately become more effective leaders and more effective human beings.
Mm-hmm. And so you mostly work with early stage companies, or what's your sweet spot?
Yeah. Given my background, you know, I've spent a lot of time around seed stage businesses and companies. So most of my clients are founders of seed to series B stage companies. Usually their teams are, you know, anywhere from, you know, as small as 5 people all the way up to, you know, 50 and scaling. There's also a couple of bootstrap profitable companies in the mix there as well.
Okay. So it's similar stage of companies that I work with for my recruiting business.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. Kind of, this is when they get funding. Maybe there's some VCs involved. Do you work mostly with the C-level execs, or do you work with, you know, anybody on the management team?
Good question. I would say probably 80% about 80% of the folks I work with are the CEO. And then the other 20 are usually C-suite. There's been a couple of folks who are more like director level, but most of the time it's the founders. I think I personally really enjoy working with the founders because I think there's a particular, you know, connection they have with the business. Usually they get really wrapped up in the work. You know, their identity is really invested into the outcome of the business. And I know you know this.
Yeah.
And how challenging that can be and how stuck people can end up feeling because of that dynamic.
Yeah. I can imagine. I like working with founders too on the recruiting side, but from an exec coach side, like that can get, I'm sure that can get really interesting, right? Founders get so tied up into it. Founders, like even myself, have just huge blind spots because we know the business, like it's our business, right? It's our baby in a way, right? How do you approach that? Like most of your clients, are they friends first, or like, do you have this kind of like divide between like friends and work? Because it can get really personal, right? Like you say stuff about my company and you're like, oh, are you saying stuff about me? Are you like attacking me if my company's not successful?
Ah, I see what you're saying. Yeah, I think, well, first of all, the folks that I work with, yeah, a few of the folks that I work with are started off, you know, people that I knew and are friends and then decided, hey, it'd be useful to work with me in this capacity. But, you know, regardless, I think there's a couple of things to note. One is, well, everything that I do with a client is always in the strictest professional, you know, manner. There's confidentiality, all that good stuff. I think it's really important, first and foremost, to make that container feel safe and protected, because the work that we do in it is not easy. It's vulnerable. It gets messy. And you can't grow if you don't feel like the conditions are set for that. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is, you know, to your point around, hey, if are you attacking me? Are you criticizing me? And like, where does their identity and their ego kind of get mixed up in all that? It's definitely tricky territory. And I would say what I always try to do is approach this situation, approach their narrative, their story with as little judgment as possible. You know, I might have opinions, right? I might have a point of view, but I view my role as being unattached to what's going on and just to really try to act as a mirror, help them see their situation a little bit more clearly. If they feel attacked or if they feel threatened in some way, I guess I try to make sure that I didn't actually contribute to that. But if there is some sort of negative emotion that's coming up, I might point to it. I might say, hey, I noticed that you are getting frustrated, or I detected some anger just now. Like, what's that about? Like, let's get curious about that. Because I think that there's something to be said about me as a coach getting too mixed up into the story. If I'm getting tripped up in my own way, right? There's something to be said about self-management. If I'm getting emotionally hooked, then I'm doing a disservice to my client. And so you know, it's really trying to be this kind of neutral observer and a mirror so that they can see what's going on. And then they ultimately will be able to figure out how they want to move forward.
Yeah, that's really important. I think, you know, keeping it professional, keeping it sort of objective if you can, as much as possible. The thing you mentioned earlier that I want to bring up is like, you're doing this in very like high confidence, right? Almost like a personal relationship that you have with these clients. How involved are like investors or advisors, or are they ever paying for these services?
I'm just scanning through my head, and pretty much everyone that I'm working with, yeah, I mean, the company is usually paying for it, but yeah, there've been a couple of times with an investor referring me, but they're not involved and there's no information that's shared outside of those sessions.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, just a personal story. Like I had a coffee meeting you know, company was having some issues, and I was meeting with a board member, or not board member, but just an investor, and it didn't go well. And I was like, I shouldn't be having this conversation with the investor, because right. you know, their business is different than my business.
Right.
And so that's when one of the few times I was like, hey, I should have called my advisors, or I should have just talked to another founder. And I think that's one of the strengths that you bring, which is like, you are a founder, you know the roller coaster ride, let's call it. Talk a little bit about that and how you bring that to your point of view for coaching.
Yeah. You know, as I was listening to you, the word that came up for me was empathy and also vulnerability. I think one of the fundamental building blocks of an effective coaching relationship is having a sense of safety, as I said earlier, and having a sense that you are both seen and heard and understood. And I think it's when the client can feel all of that, that they are then able to take some risks, to go where it might seem a little bit scary, but they know that they're feeling supported. Mm-hmm. And me being a former founder and also having been a VC and a PM, there's all these different perspectives that I can bring to the table. But I think all of those experiences that I've had in the past are really effective in helping me truly connect with what they're experiencing. If they're experiencing some sort of distress, some fear, some anger, whatever that might be, it could be joy, it could be excitement. The more quickly and the more deeply I can connect with that feeling, they're going to pick up on that. They're going to understand that. And that, you know, becomes rich, you know, fertile soil for them to grow in, you know, the ways that they want to grow. And so what does that mean in practice? It means I share the same language, same shorthand. I understand what they're talking about when it comes to, you know, their cap table or their board of directors. And like, there's, you know, one person on that's being a total asshole, or, you know, managing a team for the first time. And they're struggling to motivate people to have greater output, or maybe there's some challenge that they're experiencing with their co-founder and they can't see eye to eye. And these are all experiences that I've had, and I can relate to those directly. I think it's important to share that I don't necessarily bring my own experience specifically into it, because it's not about me, right? It's not about me bringing my own story in. It's not about me prescribing advice or here's what I would do, right? Like that, there's a very strong temptation to do that. And I think that actually separates coaching from other kind of helping modalities. Mm-hmm. An advisor or a consultant might say, I think you should try X and here's why, because I've seen it work or I have seen this not work. Yep. Sometimes I will do that if it's appropriate, but it's really framed as an invitation. And I'll tell them like, look, I'm going to offer you something. Feel free to take it or leave it. You know, I'm not invested in that either way. But again, going back to the empathy and the vulnerability component, like the more I can let them understand that I see where they're coming from and I have had a similar experience, it's like, it's a great shortcut, right? There doesn't need to be explanation there. It's like, cool, you get it. Yep. Now let's move forward, right? We can skip a lot of that stuff and that you know, someone without those experiences might have to go through.
Yeah, great. Brian, thanks for the time. We'll give you 30 seconds if you want to pitch. How do people find out about Dashing Leadership?
Yeah. If you are a founder, leader at an early stage startup and you're looking to grow more powerful, grow more conscious in your leadership and ultimately become that the better version of that, feel free to reach out. You know, website is dashingleadership.com. Email address is brian@dashingleadership.com. I'm also super active on Twitter under the handle Brian M. Wang, M as in Matthew, to share a lot of thoughts there. But yeah, I love to work one-on-one with founders who are on the path, on the journey, and are looking to do the work. So come give me a shout.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks again for the time. And
thanks, Hong.
Hopefully we can do this in person next time. I still want to hold Wes.
We will make an episode two or part two, and we'll make it happen.
All right. Cool, all right, man. See ya. Have a good one.
Bye.
Yep. Bye.
You too. You know, if you've never worked out, you know, a day in your life, I think it's kind of a bad idea to go walk into a CrossFit gym and just like go do the workout of the day, you know, at weights that more experienced people are doing. Like, you're just going to get wrecked, just completely destroyed. And so it's kind of the same thing here, right? Like, I'm not going to ask someone to completely change the way they're communicating with their team, for example, overnight. That's going to require a series of steps. And so part of that is to help break those into those digestible steps.